www.thebrainfarm.com.
This is Chris Evans recording his Storage Unpacked podcast. I'm here with Martin. How are you doing, Martin?
Yeah, not too bad, Chris. How are you?
Yeah, not bad. How's the building work going? Keeping you awake at night?
Not keeping me awake at night. Keeping me awake during the day.
Is it? Oh, crikey.
It's made teleconferences and working from home an interesting experience.
Yeah, it certainly doesn't help, does it? There you go. Never mind. I'm sure it'll come to an end at some point.
Yeah.
Right, we've got a guest today. We've got Addy Galvin from SpeedDB. I feel like, Addy, there should be another D in there somewhere in that name. But I'm sure you'll tell us why it's called SpeedDB or SpeedDB. Why don't you introduce yourself to everybody and just tell us what the company does?
Yes, cool. Thank you for having me. Pleasure being here. When we started the company, we tried to find a cool name that would maybe say what we're doing. So at first, we didn't have a name, and we called it ChilikDB after my co-founder's name. But ChilikDB is very hard to pronounce in English. So when we were discussing, my wife, that was actually in the kitchen, she said, "You're very fast, right? Why not SpeedDB?" So, you know, because my wife chose it, I can't change it, right? So,
well, it's done now, isn't it? Decision made. Yeah.
The company started with a big problem we needed to solve. We didn't think about building a company, but when my co-founders, Chilik and Mike, they worked for a big storage company, and they needed to use a certain technology that was very, very prevalent in the market. They tried to use it, and then they saw that it didn't function as it should have, or as it was advertised by the vendor. Then they looked inside, and they saw that this technology, which is considered the holy grail of storage engines, which is RocksDB, didn't really scale for monolithic platforms. It couldn't scale to the capacities, to the speed they needed. And then they went to the community and asked for, you know, questions, and went to Facebook, and they realized that this technology is great, but it's not built for the new data era. And then in order to solve it, they said, okay, let's develop something of our own. So they left the job and started this company with me. I worked with them before in the storage company. I joined in the CEO. They were the chief scientist and chief architect. And then we said, okay, let's take this technology and build it for the next generation of data, where unstructured data is the fastest growing segment in the data segment, where the network is full of JSONs and small objects and connected devices that needs to be handled.
Okay, we'll get into more of that detail in a moment. But let's probably help the audience a little bit. So Martin and I generally talk about storage systems. We have done a little bit on key value stores and some of the database pieces before, but clearly you're talking about storage engines here. So it might be great if you could just set the scene for people who are not entirely familiar with what the term storage engine means and what we mean by a storage engine.
Sure. So I'm actually a storage guy. I made a career in storage, so I'm well aware of the storage layer, but the storage layer is the lowest layer in the data stack. Above it, you have the database and the application. What most people do not know is this thin layer between the application or the database itself and the storage that is called a storage engine. It's actually an embedded library. It's a key value store. And all its task in the world is to take the objects, the blocks from the database itself or the application, and decide in what data structure it should reside on the media, on the storage. Now, it's a very thin layer, and it was actually hidden for many, many years because its main task is to manage the metadata. Until about a decade ago, the metadata was very, very small. But due to recent developments in how data is being treated and the fact that the connected devices are here, then the metadata actually grew exponentially, and our systems have to deal with lots of metadata. So this layer that was very, very thin and maybe unknown to many people became the bottleneck. So if you look at the data stack, you have the database, the thin layer of the storage engine, and then the storage beneath it.
Perfect. So Martin, just thinking about what some people might know and what, you know, falling back to the most obvious examples here, people who have used any of the sort of open source databases like MySQL, MariaDB would know that there are, or maybe they don't know, that there are some pluggable opportunities there. You know, you can put something in that's more ACID compliant, or you can put something in there that's for performance. There are some opportunities to modify that, aren't there, at the bottom end?
There are. We've sort of seen it in Mongo as well. Mongo changed their storage engine at various times to drive performance. So it's one of those things which I don't think a lot of people are entirely aware of, that the storage engine is absolutely key to your performance. It's kind of hidden. It's that thing. It's like if you look at the networking stack, it's right down the bottom. It's one of the things which application developers or whatever just don't care about. They don't want to know. But it's really important to them because it means they can write shoddy code if it's fast enough.
That's one way to look at it, I suppose. Yeah, I guess another analogy of the way you could think about it is the fact that if you look at the way storage arrays build and lay out their data, storage arrays will put the data onto physical disk in a certain way that guarantees a degree of performance or something else. And there is a proprietary nature to the way that storage provider lays that data out. And to a certain degree, storage engines are similar in that it's a proprietary degree of the way of laying the data out for whatever purpose you're trying to achieve.
Yeah.
So Adi, then, so now we're sort of getting acquainted with what we think a storage engine is. Let's talk about why you think in the last 10 years that the world has changed so much. Let's get into a bit more detail about that as to why it's changed and why we think we need to come up with something else that's going to fix this problem.
Yeah, great. So just one comment about the previous thing is that they say that you start noticing stuff when you start having problems, right? If you drive your car and everything's perfect, you'll never know that you have a problem in the engine, right? But yep. One time you're stuck, the car doesn't drive, then you open the engine cover and see, okay, there's an engine here. You know, many people have never seen an engine. So before this connected devices era, this storage engine was a very small, thin layer that no one actually knew anything about. People started noticing when it started to break or stutter, right?
Yeah.
I think that if you look at the evolution of data 20 years ago or 50 years ago, the companies who had masses of data were the big companies, right? With many clients and big databases. And they needed big storage and big structures to handle this data. But since the IoT and the connected devices were actually were gathering data from anywhere, from the internet, from our cars, from our mobile phones, watches, everything is connected and being connected. And now the term big data or mass data is not necessarily the size of the data, but the amount of the objects that the data is comprised of. So 10 years ago or 20 years ago, when you had petabytes of data, it could be 10 or 20 big databases. Now it can be trillions of files. Now it sounds simple, but when you have trillions of files, then the ratio between the metadata and the data that used to be 1 to 1,000 can now be 1 to 1. Or maybe 2 to 1. Sometimes the metadata itself is bigger than the data.
Yeah, now, it's a hard concept to get your head around, but I entirely agree, especially with object storage, where you can attribute lots of different key value pairs to an object that could be used for all sorts of different things like searching or other sorts of indexing. And bang, you've got a big problem because now, as you said, you're generating more metadata than you are data.
Definitely. And I can tell you that one of the challenges of every object store provider is the layer of the storage engine, is the ability now to search among trillions of files, get the right file, and do the I/O. And one of the things we are doing for these vendors is actually allowing them to do it much faster on a bigger scale and much more cost effective.
Okay. I just wanted to say one thing about the car analogy, which I thought was quite interesting. You're right. You know, that idea of like opening the bonnet and seeing the engine and thinking, you know, there's something wrong. About, I don't know, 12 months ago, I thought it'd be a good opportunity to show my younger son how a car works because he's learned to drive. He's passed his test and he might need to know this. So I thought, all tools, take him outside. Let's go and have a look. Open up the bonnet. And you know what, today, there's almost nothing you can touch. There's almost nothing you can modify. I thought I'd show them spark plugs and everything, and it's like, wow, where do I even start? So the complication of an engine in a car has become very high. Has the equivalent thing happened with storage engines that are built under modern databases that they've become super complicated and more difficult to replace or to do things with?
So first of all, I heard a new term, bonnet, which I call the engine cover.
Yep, you could call it the hood if you're in America, but it's a bonnet in the UK. Yeah, cool. But like the hat you might wear if you're a lady.
Yeah, so thanks for that. I'm already happy I came here. And I never thought about what you said when I was using the car analogy, but when you think about it, it's actually the same with storage engine. So when you look inside, you see that in almost every database, there's a pluggable storage engine. It can be InnoDB or RocksDB or LevelDB or whatever, WireTiger, Pebble. There are many players in this market. Most of them are open source, but you see the amount of customers who are actually dealing with it, almost none, simply because it's so complicated. It's a thin layer embedded library, but every one of these has hundreds, if not thousands, of parameters that are intertwined. And when you have a problem with your storage engine, you either try something else, plug and play, if it's possible, or you try to work around it. And the most prevalent way to work around it is to shard. You reach the maximum amount of capacity that the storage engine can handle, and then you shard the problem, which is something we didn't like because sharding actually causes many problems. Scalability, need to write software, very complex, and it costs money, especially if you're on the cloud. And this is something we wanted to solve. And one of the things we did in SpeedDB, we took the RocksDB, which is super complex. We don't know many companies who are actually opening RocksDB and trying to play with it. And we changed the whole data structure so it can be faster and more scalable and more cost efficient. And we eliminated all the parameters. So it's auto-tuned, it's working, it will recognize your workload and will actually solve the problems within the storage engine and not outside. So this is a very interesting angle that I will use it next time.
Okay, perfect. Excellent. Martin, I don't know what your approach would be when you're looking at these sort of problems. Bear in mind, you are involved in the structured side of things, from a daily, or used to be for a day on the daily basis, not whether you do it now as much as you used to. But it is true, isn't it? It's very easy just to sort of bypass the problem and think we'll find another way around it by basically fluffing it.
You fluff it, you throw things at it, you throw, we throw RAM caches, you throw faster storage, you try all kinds. Yeah, we used to get our hands dirty, Chris. You're old enough to remember laying things out on disk. We would do things just to make it faster. Yeah. Can't do it anymore. Actually, so your car analogy stands up. It always makes me laugh when people think they can tune storage better than a machine, because actually most of the time you can't. And now is, as you said, you've got thousands of parameters to deal with.
Absolutely. So Adi, then let's talk about RocksDB then in itself. What is specific about that, the way that that's developed in the industry? Because that's clearly something that people might not be familiar with, but obviously is quite a formation into a lot of different technologies nowadays.
Yeah, so it's pretty interesting. RocksDB actually started from a fork of a former project called LevelDB in Google, which is actually running till today, the Google Bigtable. The Facebook team, an excellent team, they took LevelDB and they tried to work with it in Facebook. And then they saw that the workloads they had in Facebook were different. They needed it to be multi-threaded. Facebook were working with the fast drives, SSDs. So they needed to change, and they made some great changes, and they actually customized LevelDB to be perfect fit for Facebook. Now, Facebook is a giant company, and RocksDB is being used in thousands of workloads, but most of them are very, very particular to Facebook. So they open sourced it and they gave it to the community, and it's a very solid technology. Everyone is using it out of the box because it's so complicated. But if you try to work on a different environment than Facebook, then it doesn't really work great for you, right? Okay. Facebook, they have no problem to shard whatever they want. And in the scale they want, they have endless capacity of servers and network. So it's very simple for them. They have a team of 200 people managing it, and that's great. But if you're a database vendor, you don't want to have a 100 people team to manage the storage engine, right? You need a plug and play. So the obvious solution is to shard. The challenge with sharding is that you need to write your software to be able to shard. And then when you scale, you need to change the way you scale. But I think for the most part, the most painful thing is the cost. Most of the vendors are moving to the cloud, and sharding means more instances. More instances, it's very easy to deploy on the cloud, but it costs money. And as funny as it may sound, we sometimes speak to potential customers and say, no, we have no problems. We simply shard it and we have 500 servers running this cluster. And we ask them, what if you could run it with 50? You would save 90% of your cloud infrastructure.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Okay, so it boils down to the fact that in order to work around things, you need to throw hardware or software or people. And we want to help customers not do that.
Okay, and I guess the sharding thing is one of those things where you've chosen a metric against which to shard the data. And that metric you choose, in my simplistic mind, thinking about it, you might, for sake of argument, this is a terrible analogy, but I'll use it anyway. But you might decide that you base it on some value, some parameter in that data, where you divide everything up alphabetically and say the A's there, or the B's there, the C's there, the D's there. So you divide them up in that sort of namespace. But in actual fact, if there isn't an even distribution across that namespace, then some of those instances might be heavier used than others. And you might find that your data changes over time, depending on what that data source is. So it seems like you would end up on an endless cycle of trying to manage that data and to be readjusting the sharding and reevaluating that all the time in order to try and optimize those resources, whatever methodology you've chosen.
Yeah, definitely. The basic challenge with sharding is that you need to predetermine how you split the data, how you cut the data into pieces. And data is dynamic. So the data is changing and you get an unbalanced sharded cluster, which actually means that you need to move data from side to side. And everyone in the data space knows that you don't want to move data. It costs money, time, people, network. And by allowing customers to store a lot more data on a single data structure, and minimize the sharding. Some sharding is sometimes inevitable because of compute, because of clustering, backup stuff. But many of the sharding done today is simply because of data limitation that we want to solve.
Okay. And I guess, Martin, you know, from your perspective, operating a large environment, I would think that you'd be not just seeing challenges with the performance of sharding, but now you've got operational issues. You know, you've got resiliency, you've got data spread across more physical components that can fail. So you've got to build in redundancy for that. You've got more stuff you've got to back up and you've got to manage. So it's not just a case of you fix one part of the problem. The sharding issue can expand out massively across many different areas.
Yeah, it does. Resilience is an issue with sharding. Recovery scenarios are issues. Working out how you're going to lay things out. Multi-data center sharding for availability and resilience. The more shards you've got, you're right. You really want to minimize the shards and stay away from it if you can. You see the network traffic between the shards, everything. It's not a pretty way of doing anything. It's a necessary way of doing things in a lot of kit stuff, but it just is not. It's complicated. It makes life. Yeah. We want to keep it as simple as possible. And any vendor can turn up and say, this is a... We can simplify this. We can improve your performance. We can improve your performance and we can simplify. That's a much better place to be.
Yeah. So before we move on, because I don't want to labor this part too much, but what's the impact in terms of performance in general of running everything in a smaller number of clusters or cluster members, if you like, smaller cluster size, in not having to go cross network to validate things and all the just general latency that would introduce, Adi? What impact is there, if any?
Right. So the first challenge is to make sure that you shard less, but being able to scale on a single node without having scalability issues, right? It means that you need to allow the customer to function in a limited CPU and memory, be very, very cost efficient, and allow the customer to scale on a single node just by adding more drives and more capacity. And allow him to write fast and read fast, which is always the dilemma, because in most of the technologies, you need to choose between a storage engine like B-tree based that will read fast or an LSM tree that will write fast. We've tried and we think we succeeded pretty well to give you the best of both worlds. We write very, very fast and we allow you to read very, very fast so we can actually scale up and not scale out in the same server. We do it with 80% less resources, so the amount of CPU and memory you have in the server is more than sufficient. So you've also more CPU and memory for your application. And what we see with our customers, and we're working, of course, with the big vendors, we allow them to run double or triple the capacity on half or a third of the resources. So we're talking about a factor between 4 to 9, which translates to money savings.
And now that's the key bit here. I mean, at the end of the day, we can go down and talk about how you've implemented this technology in a moment and all the aspects of, you know, what you've done differently. But ultimately, especially in a cloud model, less so when you're running things on your own data center, because you may have already got that bought-in cost. But if you're in a cloud model where everything's operationally charged to you and any sort of scaling you know directly translates into extra cost, it's really important to optimize. It's really important to get that down to the bare minimum you possibly can, for all the reasons you've just highlighted.
Yes, that's actually an interesting thing. Before the cloud era, sharding was a very, very complex task. You needed to buy more servers. You needed to design the cluster. It would take you time, right, to decide on the architecture, to order servers, to implement them, breaks and fixes. The data center era was super complex. In the cloud, they made it very easy. In 2 seconds, you can spin up 100 servers, use those management systems and have a cluster of 100 servers. Boom. Perfect. The only one not happy with it is the CFO when he discovers that in order to solve the problem, he's paying 5x or 6x, I think is the magic number, you know, when you move from the data center to the cloud. And now companies are looking at how can I do what I'm doing without paying so much money, right? So
yeah.
Eventually, we've developed this technology great, fast, but the customer wants to develop his technology fast and to do it very efficient. So eventually, it boils down to the money. If we can allow you to do more with less, then you'll probably be our customer or our partner. And that's what we're trying to do in this market.
Guess what, Martin? FinOps again. FinOps raises its head where we talk about cost savings and we talk about having to look at technology, not just from a technology perspective, but from a financial perspective.
Yeah, we're going to end up running a FinOps podcast one of these days, Chris.
We are. Yeah, we are. But it's true, though, isn't it? It comes back yet again to this scenario that there's not just a single metric now to measure things by. It's not just a case of saying it needs to be operationally more flexible, it needs to be this, it needs to be that. The cost comes into this so many times now.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's what we're seeing all over the time. And the cost of that whole understanding your investment and your cost, what is your return on investment, on the money you're spending? You may find, oh, yeah, your database is now running much, much faster, but it's costing you so much more money. You're not making any more money. In fact, you're probably making less.
Yeah. So clearly, Addy, you know, you're focused on saving the customer money, replacing the technology that's already there. How does that actually happen? You know, from the detail of what you're changing for the customer, what do they have to do and how would they adopt it? So can you make it as frictionless as, you know, spinning up another instance like, you know, they might do if they were sharding?
Right. So this is an interesting thing. I started my career as a technical guy, math and computer science, programmer, Unix guy. And at some point, I moved to business. And what I discovered is that if the technology doesn't really serve the business, it has no value. So one of the first things we did in the company, we decided that we will stay as much as possible RocksDB compliant. What it means is that if you're using RocksDB, we want the transition to be seamless. Our library is actually identical from the outside to RocksDB. So the drop and replace literally takes 30 seconds. You take the library, you link it, and it's done. Okay, so no single line of code change, nothing to do. Actually, our first customer, the CTO and co-founder, told me, no, we're not going to do that. We tried many storage engines. It doesn't work. We worked a lot in the engineering. It's not worth the effort. And I said, what if I send you a library and with a drop and replace, you'll see the magic happening? He said, okay, I'm going to give it, a try. And it worked, and they became our first customer, right? So from our point of view, it actually delayed our GA by a couple of months because we needed to make sure we stay compliant with RocksDB. This was the first thing. We want to come to you as a customer, and customers today are spoiled than ever. They don't want to do any change. They simply want stuff to work. So we're trying to do the maximum to be RocksDB compliant, which we are today. So from the outside, identical. From the inside, we changed everything. We said, what can we do different? I mean, RocksDB is the most investigated storage engine in the academia, in the market. You can see endless of write-ups and research has done it. We said, what can we do different that no one else did? And we said, okay, let's forget about the LSM structure. Let's forget about the basic rules of levels that you have in an LSM tree. And let's try to try different data structures within this to see how we can actually simplify the data structure to be able to be both write intensive, but not compromise on the read. So this is our IP, which is our secret sauce. But essentially, I think we did to, I can say that the simplest analogy would be that we made a change or we did to RocksDB what 3D XPoint did to the flash drives. I think when you think at it from a philosophical level, 3D XPoint actually added more vertical layers, right, to the NAND and allowed you to do more with less. So we took an LSM tree and we said, okay, let's look at it not as a vector, but as a matrix. Okay. Let's find some other dimensions within this data structure. It took us some time. Lots of
places. Yeah, not surprisingly.
Yeah. But eventually, we are still progressing and still improving. But at that point, we can safely say that we are about 10x faster than RocksDB. We can scale 100 times more, and we can do it with almost 80% less resources.
Which is, as we said already, is a critical scenario that you need to be working towards. So very quickly, just touching back on the integration piece, I think that's quite an important one there, because ultimately, any of the technologies like this, you need seamless compatibility. And we already know that things like APIs that exist in the industry, whether they're fixed APIs that have been agreed by committee, or whether they're de facto APIs like S3 in the storage arena, having APIs and having strict compatibility to that is pretty key for anybody who wants to support a platform that might scale out in the future, or might be something that they at some point want to keep compatibility with at that higher level. So the fact that you're adhering to APIs, I think, is a really important fact. We should stress that, I think, that how important that is. But in terms of where that leads you, what does that mean in terms of the way that the direction of the development of things like RocksDB will go? Because if you're adhering to the definition in the API, is that now a fixed architecture that will never evolve? Is there a degree of evolution that you now have to keep up with that the industry is heading towards? Or are you in a position where you could be driving that?
That's a very good question. And by the way, it was our first dilemma. Keeping the same API or adhere to the same API gives you the advantage of being plug and play and play with the standard. But it also limits you from additional functionality that you may want to add. And we have our backlog of features that we want to bring inside, including ML and AI of the data and stuff that we want to do, forces us to limit ourselves right now because we want to adhere to the RocksDB standard protocol. There is no standard, but RocksDB is de facto the standard of LSM. So I think that it's a matter of timing. When we are hopefully successful and able to replace most of the RocksDBs out there, then we may find ourselves the leader in this and then be able to do changes that maybe we can contribute or change the API so customers could benefit more. So I think we're looking at it as two phases. Stay compliant with RocksDB as much as we can till we are very, very prevalent in the market, and then start to drive change and add more functionality to what we want to do so we can actually come to the point where applications can connect to our key value store that will now not be a storage engine, but a data engine where we'll be able to manage the whole data layer beneath. That will be a different protocol. But in order to get there, we probably have 2 or 3 more years, to gain thousands of customers and be the standard.
Which, absolutely. So, but this is an interesting dilemma, Martin, isn't it? Because on the one hand, you want standards, but on the other hand, you want the technology to carry on to be driven in the industry and not to be beholden to one particular vendor who could therefore hold it back or could only want it to go in a certain direction. It's a really interesting, tricky scenario that we're in this, not just on-premises world, but the cloud world and just generally in where we are in tech.
Well, we found it, haven't we? We found that there is almost a move away from standards bodies to proprietary standards, but with good custodians. I mean, S3 is not part of a standards body. But they're a relatively good custodian. They don't, they're not breaking things. And actually, one of the things, as they've always said, don't break anything. So that's quite a useful thing. And I think that's what we'd be looking for. Don't break existing functionality. I mean, extending functionality may be a, we can have a discussion about that after you embrace it, extending from a Microsoft era when they talked about open source. I mean, that's, but it needs to be done in an open way. And it also needs to make sure that you never break anything which has gone before. I mean, that's the key with some of this stuff.
Yeah, it's tricky, but tricky balance to get right. But I think, you know, ultimately, there's got to be some impetus that moves us forward. And if you're in a position where something comes along and is infinitely better than the previous solution, you have to question, is that now the way you take it forward? It's very difficult when you've got a lot of historical environments to support us to see how that would actually happen. But, you know, it'll be an interesting one to see where it goes.
I have an interesting analogy here. There is a famous politician here that was a very successful businessman before he got into politics. And he said, I'm going to donate a lot of money to charities and to, you know, like movements. I want to change things, but I don't want to be a politician, right? No one wants to be a politician. Mm-hmm. And at some point he became a politician and people asked him, why did you do that? He said, because I realized that if you want to change the system, you can't be from the outside. You need to be from the inside. So he became a politician. You know, you need to adhere to the politics and, you know, play the politics game, which is not always nice. And you're not always, you know, perceived as a good person as you were before. But he's moving step by step towards changing things from the inside. Right. So we see this like we're restricting ourselves today to the RocksDB API. But once we're there and we're dominant and customers will trust us, we'll be able to widen the support and the API and hopefully bring much more functionality that everyone will benefit from.
So all of that seems, you know, very interesting, Andy, the way that's, you know, you're sort of focusing the way you think you want the company to be in terms of getting in there and being that, you know, the next evolution of the RocksDB platform. But it sounds to me like we need a little bit of help in the industry to understand why this is so important. So there's still a bit of work to do to help customers really understand that this is important to their ongoing data challenges going forward, because storage is done. I shouldn't say storage is done. People say that, don't they? Storage is done, but it isn't. But ultimately, this seems to be that an area where this is going to be more important than anything in terms of how people scale their data in the future.
Yeah. So I think when you look at the evolution of the data stack, we talk about applications that are limitless, databases that has evolved tremendously, scale up, scale out, different protocols, structured, unstructured. There's tons of innovation there. Storage companies, very successful, very big, came to the point where storage is almost a commodity. It's about everything is working fine. It's just a matter of dollar per gig. But the forgotten piece there is the layer between them that enables them to talk effectively. And we think that this is the next thing to be actually taken care of to complete the data flow between the application, database, and the storage smoothly and enable them to scale linearly. And we think that if this is done correctly, then customers will be able to do much more with much less. It will enable companies to deal with their data effectively, faster, and cheaper. That's what our goal is.
Excellent. I think, Martin, looking at this, I'm always interested that we talk about different bits of technology. You know, sometimes we'll talk about the hardware. Sometimes we'll talk about advances in software. Sometimes we'll talk to vendors who've looked at the hardware and thought of a better way to make that hardware work more efficiently. And then we see there's another bottleneck. We see something else we need to address or another challenge to scalability, to operations, to cost. And we're hitting that mark again, aren't we?
There's always another bottleneck, and I think, as Addy was talking about, the thing we've actually seen in the explosion of data is the number of records. Mm-hmm. And that's what's really killing everything. It's like, there's always this mistake about big data, and the big data, it's lots of little things all the time. And our traditional storage engines and storage arrays aren't very good at dealing with this. We need a better way of dealing with this. And I think technologies like this is where we need to be. And that's what's going to drive some of the things around the Internet of Things or this heavy instrumentation we're beginning to see. So is this sort of technology? I think we're going to see more of this. And I suspect we might see more VC interest in some of this because this is a problem which is going to need to be fixed.
So how are people deploying your technology today, Addy, and how could they choose to deploy it if they wanted to go out after this, listening to what we've said, and are all spurred up to go out and to do something about it? What's typically the way that people are using the technology?
Right. So right now, we've developed our embedded library that is compliant with RocksDB. So we're going for the OEM route to speak to application and database vendors. For them, it's just to plug and play, replace their current storage engine with ours. And we've just started. We launched in November 2021. We have three big OEMs during our first year, which we were very happy with. There are hundreds of vendors out there that can use our technology, including the cloud providers themselves. They have tons of data and they need this technology. So we have a long way to run with this OEM play. But in the middle of this year, we want to take our first steps in the open source and release a first open source version. We were very, very reluctant to do that because we were very afraid of our IP, but we came to conclusion that open source is the way to scale. So we will reveal some of it to the open source, and we'll go with an open core model. We'll have an enterprise offering for the OEMs and an open source version for the community. And we really want to build a huge community that will use SpeedyB. You know, let the people enjoy the technology and enable them to develop their platforms on a much scalar storage engine. What else? We want to eventually be the de facto standard of a storage engine out there. That's our goal.
Excellent. I think this is an interesting play simply because it's very easy to see how you could be acquired, or at least you could become a customer of all the big cloud providers simply because they already have many of the database platforms as managed services. So from their perspective, any opportunity they can have to improve performance, reduce costs for their customers, you'd think that they'd want to do that. Now, they might not want to do that because they don't get the benefit of sharding the data. But if they're managing it themselves, that is an opportunity that they could want. So the potential scale for this, the market for this within the hyperscalers should be huge.
Yeah, I agree. The fact that we are an embedded library gives us a lot of flexibility with the places we can actually help.
Absolutely. Martin, any final thoughts?
No, it's been an interesting conversation. It's one of these things which we don't normally talk about. We don't normally talk about embedded libraries. When you're talking about users and use cases, it really is going to be that most people are using storage engines at the moment, which doesn't tend to be a large number of end users. Yeah, there are some big end users who might be interested where they're doing their own custom stuff. But that will be, and obviously in Venus, we see it moving to the open source. If it gets adopted within the open source world, we'll see it potentially become core of a number of open source projects. And that will be a real growth opportunity for Addy's and SpeedDB.
Yeah, excellent. Okay, well, Addy's speeddb.io for the website.
SpeedDB. People want to go and... One word.
SpeedDB, yeah.
SpeedDB.
Okay.
Yeah, you got it.
So we'll put the link into the show notes, but, you know, I'd encourage people to go and have a look and understand this, because this is going to be quite important going forward for everybody just to be aware. But, you know, for now, thanks very much for your time. It's been really interesting to understand it, and it's a great introduction to the technology. We look forward to catching up with you in the future.
Thank you, guys. It was a real pleasure.
You've been listening to Storage Unpacked. For show notes and more, subscribe at storageunpacked.com. Follow us on Twitter at Storage Unpacked, or join our LinkedIn group by searching for Storage Unpacked Podcast. You can find us on all good podcatchers, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. Thanks for listening.